From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from the harem to the Islamic Revolution, we talk with Satireh Farman Farmoyan. Her father was a Persian prince sentenced to house arrest by the new Shah. She introduced the profession of social work to Iran, but she was nearly executed after the revolution. She now lives in exile in America. Also today, we talk with British actor Michael York. And we check out two new events in rock. The MTV acoustic music series Unplugged opens its new season with an Eric Clapton concert. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the group Little Village, featuring veteran rockers Ry Cooder, John Hiatt, and Nick Lowe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The polls have just closed in some of the Super Tuesday primary states, and President Bush is the projected winner in the Republican contest in Florida. No word yet on the Democratic candidates, for whom Florida has been the most hotly contested Super Tuesday primary, with 148 Democratic convention delegates. Democratic and Republican primary elections are also being held in Louisiana, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Tennessee, and Texas. The Democrats are holding caucuses in Delaware, Missouri, and Hawaii. President Bush is expected to roll up victories in all eight Republican primaries today. Bush campaign manager Robert Teeter told reporters that exit polls show the president meeting or exceeding expectations in the balloting. Paul Tsongas is back on friendly turf tonight in New England, the one area of the country where the former U.S. senator seems a sure bet to win presidential primaries tonight. Sam Fleming of member station WBUR reports.
Democrat Paul Tsongas returned to Lowell, Massachusetts late this afternoon to vote and then sit back and watch the returns before his campaign heads out tomorrow for another round of primaries next week. Perhaps because Tsongas was expected to do so well here, the turnout in Massachusetts today has been extremely low, perhaps 20% of registered voters. The story in Rhode Island seems to be the same. Both states are Tsongas strongholds, a comfortable oasis against the strong tide of Southern support for Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. On the Republican side, President Bush is expected to come out on top in both states, despite another significant protest vote from challenger Patrick Buchanan. For National Public Radio, I'm Sam Fleming in Boston.
Combined exit polling data from the four major television networks now project Bill Clinton, the winner of the Florida Democratic presidential primary. Former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas finished second, and former California Governor Jerry Brown was third. The Pentagon acknowledged today that a North Korean freighter believed to be carrying Scud missiles for Iran or Syria has avoided a U.S. Navy search and slipped undetected into an Iranian port. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Defense Department spokesman Pete Williams told reporters, "We did not encounter the ship. I can't tell you why." U.S. officials had said they were extremely concerned about the freighter and the possible delivery of missiles to an already volatile region. But Williams argued today the search for the freighter was not the highest priority. The ship apparently hugged the coastline, evading U.S. detection. Even if the U.S. Navy had intercepted the freighter, officials conceded there was not much they could do beyond searching the ship and establishing if indeed there were North Korean missiles aboard. While authorized to stop ships that may be destined for Iraq, the U.S. has no authorization to divert ships and cargo headed for Iran.
This is NPR News. Air Force Secretary Donald Rice said today that it will cost about $2 billion to fix problems and upgrade the nation's B-1 bomber fleet. Rice told a House Appropriations Subcommittee that the monies needed to equip the planes with a system to jam enemy radar, to add conventional munitions, and to provide for in-house maintenance. The Air Force's 97 B-1 bombers have been plagued with problems ever since they were put into service in 1986. The planes, designed to counter a Soviet attack, cost $280 million each. Three of the planes have crashed, including one that went down when a bird struck above an engine. The defense in the drug trafficking trial of Manuel Noriega rested today without the testimony of Panama's former military leader. From Miami, Melissa Mancini reports.
Manuel Noriega said he decided against taking the stand in his own defense because the court had placed certain restrictions on his testimony. In an early morning hearing, the presiding judge had ruled the general could not discuss political matters, issues of war, or the U.S. invasion of Panama. Noriega said he didn't want his decision against taking the stand to be interpreted as an admission of guilt. Standing in chambers, the general told the judge and government prosecutors that he was prepared to answer questions, however, would not because his testimony would be limited. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Alaska's Iditarod Trail sled dog race is nearing a finish, with the leader nearly 40 miles ahead of his competition. Swiss-born musher Martin Boozer is taking a mandatory 8-hour rest in the village of White Mountain, just 77 miles from Nome. Boozer could finish the race late today or early tomorrow, cutting hours off the 1990 record of 11 days and 2 hours set by 4-time champion Susan Butcher. Butcher herself was in second place, followed by Tim Osmar. Another well-known woman musher, Dee Dee Jonro, was close behind. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're interested in the Middle East, the lives of women in Islamic cultures, and the friction between tradition and westernization, I think you'll be interested in the story of my guest, Satareh Farman Farmoyan. She's the daughter of an Iranian prince, but shortly after she was born, the family's dynasty was overthrown, and Reza Pahlavi crowned himself Shah. Her father spent the rest of his life under house arrest. Her mother was one of his several wives. Satareh grew up in a harem in the family compound. In spite of all the restrictions on women's behavior, she went to college in the United States. She returned to Iran to start her country's first school of social work, devoting her life to helping the poor and the sick. But some of her own students turned against her during the revolution and took her to the authorities, telling her the Ayatollah would have her executed. She managed to escape from the country and now lives in exile in Los Angeles. She's written a new memoir called Daughter of Persia. I asked her to describe the relationship between her mother and the other wives in the harem.
You know, when I was growing up, you know, we were all children and we loved each other. We didn't know for a long time. I didn't know the difference because, you know, when I was born, that was the time that my father was imprisoned. All his elder sons were imprisoned. So my mother, who was very young when she married my father, she was 12. And she was a young woman. She was scared or went through all this hardship. So she didn't have, she was breastfeeding me. And she lost her, what they say, that her, she couldn't nurse me. She was sick. So I was nursed by my stepmother, who at the same time I was born, she had a son who is only about 10 days younger than I am. So I was breastfed by her. And so I grew up not knowing who was really my mother. So, but the relationship between the wives, they were all these four, especially the three of them, were the same age, with the difference of 1 or 2 years older than younger. So they were young and they were confined to their own andarun, that means that their own household. My father would not allow them to go outside and search for activities outside the household. So they became very good friends. They cooked together, they sewed together, they socialized together. They talked a great deal about my father, and my father was a sort of traditional man who believed that the children should be clean, the children should be educated. So they talked a lot when we were growing up together, and we really didn't know any difficulty in their relationship. I never felt. And as a matter of fact, when my father died, these wives kept on seeing each other, and they were the best friend. And one time, I remember that when my stepmother, who had nursed me, died, my father, own mother, grieved so much. She cried a lot, and she kept on telling us that she lost her best friend, and there's no reason for her to keep on going. You see, the love for each other was that much.
Did you want to marry when you were very young?
Well, there was a lot of glamour attached, and that was the only job, or only activity that they saw for girls. You see, we were not allowed to participate in politics. I mean, the girls I'm talking, we were not allowed to go to the to schools like the boys did. You see, when I was growing up, all my brothers who were the same age as I was, they were all sent abroad for education when they got to be 8, 9 years old. And I stayed home because I was a woman. So, and the only destiny I had as far as they were concerned was that for me to get married and have children. And so they glamorized it in a way. And when you are stuck to a confined anderun, and all you have in the future is they talk about, oh, soon you will find somebody who will bring you jewelry, who will bring you this. You see, any young girl is sort of tantalized by that. But I was more interested in getting education. My father was an enlightened and very, I can say that he believed in education. He educated his daughters, not sending them abroad, but in the schools available. He brought us tutors inside our homes. And my elder sisters, they all had a governess, a French governess. You see, when I got to be of age, he sent me to a school outside our compound. So he believed in education. He taught us to search for education. And, you know, in the history of Iran, my father was the first man who started a school for girls in the city of Shiraz. At that time, there was no girls' school in the whole country. So he really thought of education as an activity that the girls could attend and learn, you see.
I think it's always a challenge for contemporary American women to understand what it was like to grow up in a harem, and also to understand the restrictions that were living with the restrictions that were placed on women then. I mean, the women were basically confined to the house. Were there women in the compound where you were growing up who resented it, who wanted freedoms they didn't have? Did you, when you were young, want freedoms that you were afraid you would never have?
Yes, it was. You see, my father had organized everything we needed in the compound. We had school there. We had a carpentry shop there. We had a blacksmithy shop there. We had whatever. It really was a city in itself. And so the people who lived in the compound, they didn't need to go outside. But I know that my mother was very, very mad at my father, and she never forgave my father, even at the time that after even the death of my father, she always complained that he did not let her go out of the compound when my mother's mother was sick and died. So she didn't go to the deathbed of her mother. So that was the type that the people, I mean, the women were restricted.
Now, you described yourself as something of a tomboy when you were growing up.
Correct. Because I was growing up with a bunch of boys. There was all my age group were boys.
So did you have certain freedoms that weren't usually given to girls?
Yes, I had because, you know, I was unruly, and I probably, my mother didn't have any playmates, girls, for me in the compound. So she just put pants like the boys on me and sent me out like the boys. So I grew up in the Biruni, that is the, that's where the little boys were. I mean, that was up to the time that the boys had gone to Europe. So I grew up with them.
You keep using the word compound to describe where you grew up.
Yes.
It was also a harem. Do you not like to use the word harem? Do you think Americans have, like, the wrong image of what that word means?
Yes, they did. I don't want it to be associated with Hollywood. For us, it's when I say compound, because it was a very large area of land, walled in, and in it there were houses for every wife, and each house was quite large, and we all had our own garden, our own. Our house was a two-story with 6-7 bedrooms and servants' quarters. You see, the same was with others. And then in the middle of the compound was my father's house. So therefore, it wasn't harem in a way that it's pictured in Hollywood. You see, it was real life. It was like people's home. The only way that was different was that we didn't have a father inside living with us. You see, and I never thought of it differently. I thought that the whole world was like that. The father always lived in his own quarter, you see. So when we were growing up, this was not a problem for me.
My guest is Satareh Farman Farmoyan. Her new memoir is called Daughter of Persia, a woman's journey from her father's harem through the Islamic Revolution. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Satareh Farman Farmoyan, and she's the author of a new memoir called Daughter of Persia, a woman's journey from her father's harem through the Islamic Revolution. You came to the United States to be educated. This was for college, I think, was when you first came to the United States. What did going to the West mean to you and mean to your father, who was the one who supported your trip?
My father died when I was still in high school. So after the death of my father, I decided to pursue my education, and I came to the United States. My father, I just want to tell you about my mother. My mother was very unhappy about my decision at first, but because war broke out, this is World War II, and it took me a couple of years to get a visa and to prepare my trip. Then during that period, my mother got used to the idea. So I came to the United States in search of better education. I wanted to do something for my people. I was concerned about the poverty, the illiteracy, the position of women, and all the social problems that I saw outside the compound. So I wanted to do something, and I thought that the best thing, since we were not allowed to go to university or to school in Iran, university was very new and only for men, so I decided that I'll come to United States. So I got acquainted with the American missionaries there, and they helped me.
What made you think that you, as a woman, could do important work?
Well, I saw no difference. You know, when I thought that I ran as fast as my little brothers. I climbed the trees as high as they did. I did all sorts of things. I memorized the poem our father gave on Fridays and learned whatever our lessons. I was doing very good at school, even better than boys, and I read whatever I was supposed to do. So I said, well, I am not behind them. Why? So the girls could do whatever the boys can do. Why shouldn't I?
Well, you went to the United States to go to college and then lived in the United States for a while, eventually returned to Iran, where you started a school to train people in social work, people who would then go on and help the poor. What do you think of as being the greatest accomplishments of your school over the years?
Well, we introduced the profession of social work. You see, the profession of social work was unknown. I coined the word social worker into the Persian vocabulary. You see, Iran is several thousand years old. So that was an accomplishment. We showed people that there is a profession, that the social problems are can be solved through education. And so I think that was a big accomplishment. People, you know, took for granted. See, I told you that they were so religious that they thought that every breath that a person takes is predestined by God. So if a person is poor, she has to be like that. So it was total submission to God's will. If you were sick, that's it, that God wants you. You see, they kept on telling me, oh, don't try to do this. The future of people is written on their forehead. Well, that wasn't so. I knew that people could help themselves. Of course, I didn't deny there was a God, but I said, well, God can help you to help yourself. You see, that concept I introduced, that you can help yourself to, you can go to the doctor and you can have, you know, I started the family planning program in Iran, which meant that all these women who were young and having a child every year, and they were so weak that you would think at the age of 28, they had six children. They looked to me as they were 50. So I said, well, look, you can have less children and watch you for your own health, and you will become stronger, and you can do all sorts of things. And this happened. They did it. They protected themselves. They followed and they took care of their health. So women became somebody in the household, and they were not only for giving birth.
I want to skip ahead to the late 70s, in the period right before the revolution and the overthrow of the Shah. When you could sense that a revolution was coming, what were your feelings then toward the Shah and toward his secret police, the Savak?
Well, you know, Mehmed Reza Shah, that was the Shah that during the revolution came during his time. He did accomplish a great deal for Iran. I mean, we have got to give him credit. We have Iran was changed in one generation to become a modern country. You see, we had roads, we had schools, we had hospitals, we had big military installment. But the problem was that what he neglected was the politics was not a part of everybody's life. You see, here in this country, your political system is everybody's business. But there, the people did not contribute to political thoughts. You see, they were not allowed to participate in political and planning, you see. So it was the job of the Shah and his own ministers. Therefore, I felt a great gap between the people and the administration and the Shah, you see. He couldn't understand that a human being by nature it has a free soul, and we wanted to be free in contributing to our own lives. We wanted to participate in political ways of life.
Let me skip ahead to when the Ayatollah took over in Iran and the Shah was overthrown. You describe a very harrowing incident in your book after the Ayatollah took over, when a group of students came to your door and told you that they were coming to take you so that the Ayatollah could execute you.
Correct.
What were their reasons? What did they tell you?
They were, you know, in revolution and in crisis, I have a feeling that people really think differently. They have... they are not under discipline, and they think that now, oh, if we get rid of her, she has been the director of the school, then we can have her job. Maybe she has stolen a lot of money. We can get hold of that money. So they are not thinking straight. Everybody is thinking what we'll get. You see, a lot of people thought that if I am not there, they can confiscate my belongings, my home, you see, so they had other motives in their mind. So I was scared. I mean, I thought that they were going to send me to Ayatollah, and Ayatollah was going to kill me. But I said, well, all right, let's go to Ayatollah and let him talk to me. I felt that all my life I had been a teacher, I had been helping the poor, I had been doing what any religion wants a human being do. I didn't think that I was guilty of anything.
Well, the students told you that they thought that you and your school were serving the imperialist interests of the CIA.
Yes, they had about 10, 12 charges against me. And, you know, I had, during the 20 years of School of Social Work, I had sent many students abroad for further education. I had sent students to United States universities, to England, to France, to the Philippines, to India, to all places that I thought that the students can become acquainted with new thought, and they can bring back something of interest to Iranian community. So I had sent many, many students abroad. So the students thought that that was CIA activity, you see.
When you were taken off to the jail, you heard gunshots, and it turned out those are the shots of other people getting executed.
Correct.
What saved you from being executed?
Well, because I was the first woman to be taken, I think that saved my neck, really, because the students were in such a hurry to take me the first day that when I got there, they didn't know what to do with a woman prisoner, you see. So they had me stand in the headquarters of Ayatollah Khomeini outside on the wall, while the men prisoners were inside and they were executed. So they didn't know what they should do for me. And then I was also lucky that number two to Ayatollah Khomeini, Ayatollah Talaghani, knew me. You see, he had heard that I was, people over there wanted to know, who is this woman who is standing there for on the wall, and he heard my name. He said, oh, yes, I know her. She has been coming to the prison for all these years. She has helped the wives of and the children of the prisoners. So he petitioned for me. You see, I was really lucky in that aspect.
So you were finally able to get a visa and leave the country. What's the difference between the kind of social work you're doing in Los Angeles now and the type of work that you did in Iran?
In Iran, I was educating. I was in the School of Social Work, and I was working with the government in planning and program and introducing a lot of legislation. I was doing a lot of work for social welfare planning and programming. Here, when I came to United States, I just sat in the civil service exam, and I'm doing straight social work, which is my field, and I like it a lot. It's a good thing.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Satare Farman Farmoyan has a new memoir called Daughter of Persia. It's published by Crown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Michael York has written a memoir chronicling his years in the British theater, his screen career, including the movies Cabaret and The Three Musketeers, and his work on Broadway. Coming up, we talk with Michael York. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new all-star band of rockers who aren't quite stars. The new group, Little Village, features John Hiatt, Nick Lowe, Ry Cooter, and Jim Keltner. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of the MTV acoustic music series Unplugged, featuring guitarist Eric Clapton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Florida, Governor Bill Clinton and President Bush are projected winners in their respective presidential primaries, with challenger Patrick Buchanan picking up a projected 33% of the vote on the Republican side. NPR's David Mopus reports.
Florida is the state Paul Tsongas concentrated on in the South because it is more national than Southern in its demographics. It was expected to be the closest of the Democratic contests. Failure to win there, failure to even run a close second, as seems to be the case, has got to be a significant setback for Tsongas. Bill Clinton's victory in Florida can't be good news for Tsongas elsewhere in the South tonight, where Clinton is believed to have an even bigger edge. Clinton is doing best with working-class voters, the less educated, and minorities. Jerry Brown is a distant third in Florida. On the Republican side, projections are that President Bush wins Florida handily, but still could not put Patrick Buchanan away. It looks like Buchanan will get another 30% plus. And large numbers of voters in both parties say they did not like the choices on the ballot. I'm David Malthus.
In New York City, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz appeared at the UN today to try to persuade Security Council members to lift economic sanctions against his nation. Diplomats said that he appeared to receive very little support. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Aziz met privately with the president of the Security Council and with diplomats from the council's non-aligned countries. He later told reporters that because Iraq has complied with many of the ceasefire terms, it should be rewarded with a partial lifting of sanctions.
It's not impossible to reach an agreement on these things when people handle it in a fair manner and remove aside the biased political motives which are held by a number of states.
But officials attending the non-aligned meeting said Aziz received no assurances of support. Aziz takes his case to the full Security Council tomorrow. Council officials are expected to respond by reading a lengthy declaration enumerating Iraq's ceasefire violations. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
At a NATO meeting today in Brussels, the U.S. said that it will soon grant diplomatic recognition to both Croatia and Slovenia, but will wait before taking the same move toward other breakaway republics. Members of the European community recognized both states nearly 2 months ago. The EC and the United States have also stressed that they will not accept changes in the borders of the Yugoslav republics by force or without mutual consent. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 16 points to close at 3,230.99 on volume of some 195 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush says that he doesn't think he and former President Nixon have any differences concerning support for Russia. In a memo to friends and foreign affairs experts reported in the New York Times this morning, Nixon criticized the Bush administration for what was termed pathetic support for democratic forces in Russia. Nixon maintained that if President Boris Yeltsin fails in setting up a free market economy, all progress gained so far will be lost, and this could help dictators around the world. The year-old Peruvian cholera epidemic has advanced from the sparsely settled Amazon rainforest to the highly populous and poor northeast region of Brazil. Public health officials are concerned that cholera may now spread quickly throughout the rest of Brazil. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Cholera has hit Brazil's most impoverished region with a vengeance. More than 200 new cases have been reported since Saturday. Health authorities say they're ill-equipped to treat the disease, which has already killed 16 people in the Northeast. Brazil's health ministry, which is in charge of fighting cholera, has been immersed instead in various corruption-related scandals. Funds that were supposed to have been distributed for anti-cholera campaigns have not yet arrived. Brazil's Northeast has 45 million inhabitants, and fewer than a third of its cities have any kind of sewage system. Large numbers of Northeasterners migrate to the more prosperous south of Brazil, and authorities say it's now only a matter of time before the epidemic reaches the megalopolises of Rio and Sao Paulo. I'm David Walna in Rio de Janeiro.
The government says that productivity of U.S. workers inched up 0.3% last year after two straight years of declines. The Labor Department also says that productivity in the final 3 months of the year moved up a revised 1.7% instead of 1.1% as estimated earlier. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. MTV Unplugged, the music video network's one-hour acoustic music series, begins its new season tomorrow night with a program devoted to Eric Clapton. It's also the first Unplugged show to mix snippets of interviews with the performances, a touch that TV critic David Bianculli likes very much.
It's one of the most famous opening guitar riffs in rock and roll, with a vocal performance that cries almost as loudly as the guitar.
What do you do when you get lonely? Nobody's waiting by your side. You've been running hard much too long. You know it's just your foolish pride.
But that's not the way Eric Clapton's Layla sounds on Unplugged. Clapton has an acoustic guitar, not an electric. He's playing for a small audience in the round, 250 people tops, instead of to tens of thousands in a big arena. And Clapton, instead of just approaching this particular show as one more appearance, is positively inspired by the opportunity to make music with a small, unamplified band. The results? Listen for yourself.
See if you can spot this one.
In this show, there's also the chance to hear some Clapton compositions for the very first time, including an emotional and beautiful one about his son Connor, who died last year in a tragic accident. Once again, the interview portion of Unplugged enhances the understanding and appreciation of the song itself.
The Circus Left Town, which is about directly about my son, really. And the last night I spent with him was at a circus, in fact. So, there's not much I can say about these things except that they helped me get through a very, very hard patch of my life.
Little man with his eyes on fire,
I have no complaints about the new improved Unplugged format, but I do have two suggestions. On certain big deal occasions, and this was one, the show should be expanded to 90 minutes. And as invaluable as the interview portions are, they shouldn't be edited into the program so that they overlap the beginnings of the songs. The music, after all, is why we're there in the first place, especially if we're taping. And make no mistake, there's some terrific music to be found here. These artists come to Unplugged ready and eager to revamp their old songs, play new ones, sing cover versions of some old favorites, and explore musical ideas that don't necessarily work in front of larger crowds. It's a treat for them, and a treat for viewers, and it's also the best hour MTV has to offer. MTV Unplugged proves, once again, that less is more.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. This is Fresh Air. I always thought Michael York's name had the ring of class. Well, it turns out he took his last name from York Cigarettes, which was a new brand at the time. I found that out in his new memoir, Accidentally on Purpose. The book tells about York's stage and screen career. He got his start in Laurence Olivier's fledgling theater company, the National Theater. One of the company's directors was Franco Zeffirelli, who later gave York his first film role in Taming of the Shrew. York went on to star in Romeo and Juliet, Cabaret, The Three Musketeers, Logan's Run, and Murder on the Orient Express. He's now living in Los Angeles, but with the exception of a short run on Knott's Landing, he hasn't done much American TV. The role he's probably best known for in America is the young Englishman in the film adaptation of Cabaret. He told me he was anxious to do the film, but he was horrified when he read the script.
Well, it was my own stupid fault. I'd agreed to do the film, and it was I knew the, you know, the Isherwood books, and I'd seen the stage show, and I hadn't really studied the new script, because partly because I was involved. I was doing a film in Morocco for Philippe de Broca, and switched my attention on arriving in Munich, where the film was made, and read the script with a sinking heart, because I realized that my character was exactly like Isherwood. I am a camera. He was a kind of passive observer, around him revolved these extraordinary extrovert characters, but he was a kind of a pallid, strange presence. And I wonder what on earth to do. I walked around Munich in the pouring rain all night, kind of flagellating myself mentally, not wishing to give the impression that I was a neurotic actor, but not knowing Bob Fosse. I'd met him at an audition. He seemed nice enough. But anyway, I plucked up courage and went to his hotel and unburdened myself. And to my delight, he agreed that indeed he thought the narrative passages needed some work on. And moreover, we had 2 weeks where all the song and dance numbers were to be rehearsed. And he wanted to work on the narrative in that time, and brought in Hugh Wheeler, this wonderful, wonderful writer.
Didn't he write the book of Sweeney Todd for Stephen
indeed.
Sondheim's musical?
Oh, yes, and Little Night Music, yes. And in his presence, we improvised and started kind of fixing things and trying out new things. And in the course of those 2 weeks, a real solid, I think, interesting character began to emerge. So it was a very valuable time.
Your character in the film Cabaret is clearly bisexual. Were there any discussions over that or fights over that. Anybody say, oh, no, we'll have to edit that part out. That won't do.
Not at all, no, no. I mean, it was, I suppose it was a sign of the times that one could, you know, speak more freely about these kind of things. You know, Isherwood had himself had been unable to. In fact, I asked him, because he enjoyed the film. In fact, we read the notices together in his little house in Santa Monica, and I said, are you happy with it? And the only thing that he slightly kind of felt uncomfortable with was, in fact, the bisexuality of it all.
As opposed to homosexuality.
And I said, did you ever have an affair with Sally Bowles? And he said, no, but they did once go to bed. In fact, the apartment was full of guests, and they found they had to share a bed together. And I said, well, you know, did anything happen? And he said, no. and that's as close as it went.
Let's talk a little bit about The Three Musketeers, directed by Richard Lester. He was playing around with a lot of new techniques in this movie, and you were doing a lot of sword fighting in the movie. So was there a lot of mayhem on the set during these comic scenes?
I think I say somewhere that comedy is usually kind of sheer bloody hell to make. And, you know, the most serious plays are usually full of kind of giggles and laughs. It's kind of rule of thumb. The Musketeers, it was hard work. I mean, for me, I had 11 major duels. So when I wasn't actually filming them, I was rehearsing them. But they were, you know, people, the best laid plans, accidentally on purpose and all that. People did get hurt, almost, but not, you know, seriously hurt.
Did you get hurt?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think on the second day, I we were dueling away, and the sequence called for me to be disarmed, and then I shout rather heroically for a sword, and I think Atos throws me one from the other side of this courtyard, and indeed he did, and it came scything through the air, and the sun was in my eyes, and I missed hold of it, and the whole thing kind of slashed right across my face and cut into my nose, and you learn that you do that with a kind of wooden sword. And also, things happen in the heat of the moment. It's like a kind of real battle. The blood is up and the adrenaline's flowing, and you do things that, in other circumstances, a kind of simple caution would forbid.
Didn't you have a stuntman?
Oh, yes, yes. But I remember my double got injured, and I started doubling for my double. No, I mean, by and large, it's something actually that I feel very strongly about. It. In fact, we made a sequel to the Musketeers, and in fact, Roy Kinnear, who was a wonderful, wonderful actor who played my servant Kinnear, was killed as a result of a fall on the set, and it put things in a dreadful perspective. And it brought home the fact that what I was doing was, you know, potentially lethal. And it was a dreadful time, and one that I think, cast a shadow for a long time and still does.
How did the people making the movie continue making the movie, especially making a comedy after the death of one of the actors on the set?
Well, it was terrible. I mean, it was, as you can imagine. But we all agreed to do it because we were halfway through, and, Roy's performance, we wanted to keep it there. So it was finished with a double and by, you know, changing things around. I don't know why I kind of got onto this, because it's usually something one keeps quiet about. It's there in the book, because I felt if you're writing about, you know, your life story, it's not all sweetness and light, and it's about things that affect you. Had a legitimate place. But I haven't, you know, it's there. but obviously one feels uncomfortable talking about it.
No, in addition to movies, you've done a lot of theater. You started your career in theater, but you've done Broadway in the United States. You went to the opening of Stephen Sondheim's A Little Night Music, and you write that sitting in the theater on opening night, you say, "My heart flooded with compassion for those about to be so cruelly exposed at the curtain's rise, all their hopes and ambitions at the mercy of the same small firing squad of critics." What bad experience did you have that made you feel this way?
Well, I know how they're feeling. It's a very nerve-wracking thing to be. And it's exciting, but it is. The nervous tension does run high. And you do seek, the approbation of the audience. But usually it's not the audience so much. The audiences are fine. But it's the way that the system runs, and I think it's incredible. Especially I'm speaking to you from New York, where, the approbation of a single critic secures the success or failure of a play. It's a total nonsense. And my most recent Broadway endeavor, for example, was to work for Tony Randall, who had this brilliant idea of creating a repertory company to do the classics on Broadway at affordable prices with, actors working for scale. And the New York Times critic was so mean-spirited about this, about this idea, that I just gasped with disbelief that a man could write like in so vituperative a way and not to welcome the idea of someone trying to, do something about it.
Since some of your best-known roles are from Cabaret and The Three Musketeers, Logan's Run, do you find that a lot of people don't realize that you're going on 50, that they think of you as being a lot younger than you are?
I don't know. It's always so hard to... the perceived apprehension that people have of you. I honestly don't know. And I've never stopped working, and because the great thing about this job is that you there's no cut-off time, that you go on until, if you have your wits and your health, until you drop. Because, there's no retirement age, and so you have, for example, the glorious situation of someone like John Gielgud, Prosper's book, still in his mid-80s, giving brilliant performances, or George Abbott at 105, still, still active. That's what I love about it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Michael York's new memoir is Accidentally on Purpose. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have Super Tuesday primary news as it develops. Also, this discussion about presidential imagery, the importance of looking like a statesman. It's an inexact science, to be sure. An assessment of Saddam Hussein and the atomic bomb. A talk with Gary Milholland of the Wisconsin Project. A report from Norwood, Ohio, doing without a General Motors plant after 5 years now. And doing quite well, thank you. Also, from Japan, the story of cable radio coming right into your home or apartment, more than 400 radio channels, all Elvis, for example, all American country and Western music, anything you want, including the inside sounds of a human body.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Four veteran rockers, all longtime cult favorites, have formed a new band they call Little Village. Guitarist Ry Cooder and John Hiatt, bassist Nick Lowe and drummer Jim Keltner first came together to work on Hiatt's 1987 album Bring the Family. Ken Tucker has a review of the new album, Little Village.
Before I found out that the members of Little Village took their name from a song by bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson, I thought perhaps that Little Village was the name of the retirement community that the traveling Wilburys had checked into. Like the Wilburys, these middle-aged codgers are crack musicians who strive for a homey, even creaky feeling in their music.
I need love as big as an ocean. I need love that don't get crossed. Love in perpetual motion. I need a love that don't get lost. Now, do you know where this love can be found? Do you know where this love can be found?
Little Village is a charming but limited concept. For one thing, there's no real vocalist in this act. Cooter and Nick Lowe have always gotten by on wobbly croons. Jim Keltner is too busy slamming the drums, and so on most cuts, John Hiatt takes the lead with his scratchy croak. There's also a certain vagueness to the lyrics in the songs. They all seem to be about the same thing. Women. Can't live with them, can't get a hot meal without them. All the songs on Little Village are credited to the entire quartet, but bright bits of personality shine through occasionally. For example, Take Another Look is one of only two songs that Nick Lowe sings, and it has his trademark paradox, melancholy jauntiness, all over it.
Maybe you have seen the party, and you think I won't do. But inside, see I'm lonely, and I need someone true. Just say the word, and I'll learn to fly. Take another look at what you find. Cause what you find may be alright.
Little Village is a bunch of white guys steeped in soul and R&B sitting around trading licks and making small private jokes. If that sounds like a lukewarm review, well, lukewarm is what these guys are aiming for, even when they're hot.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross.
She runs hot for me. She runs hot for me. She runs hot for me. Well, now she might run cold for you. She runs hot for me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Everyone has been wondering how Clarence Thomas will change the direction of the Supreme Court. On the next Fresh Air, we examine what the court's latest decisions reveal about the new court. We'll talk with Duke University law professor Walter Dellinger. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.